Right, we're going to continue with biblical prophecy and postmillennialism. This is the 32nd week. It's part 31 of Historical Expectations According to the Bible. Part 10 of the Eschatology of the Book of Revelation. We are on chapter 10. Westminster Confession, chapter 3, section 2. Although God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, yet has he not decreed anything because he foresaw it as future or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. That brings us to chapter 10. In chapter 10, really through chapter 11, verse 14, there is a literary parenthesis. The parenthesis is to help us understand sort of the background preparation for what occurs with the third woe, the seventh trumpet, and all of that which is coming in the history of the church. If you remember, the two woe trumpets, the second woe had to do in particular with that final spread of Islam in the East, but it was a spread that impacts the Western Church. It impacts the Church to the point that well into the 17th century, the Western Church felt the danger of Islam. And that's what makes the third woe so troubling as we approach it. And that's why there's this preparation. In the Western Church, we saw a transition from the early period of time where the heathen empire is persecuting Christianity, and then we see that Constantine is converted, the empire becomes Christian, and really what happens is the world begins to flow into the church. That situation continues for quite some time. But there is, in it, as we'll see, with this third woe, there is, in fact, in the West, a separate Antichrist from the Eastern Antichrist, the Western Antichrist, that is in process of development. That begins really from the time of the dissolution of Imperial Rome and it becoming Christian Rome. There's an entire period of time where that's beginning to develop and show itself for what it is. Now, the Roman Empire divides into ten horns, ten kingdoms, ten powers. And of those, three are going to give way for the little horn, for the Western Antichrist, for the papacy in particular, for not just the papacy, but really what ends up constituting the Holy Roman Empire, because the church ends up running that to a large extent, and it's still, to a certain extent, running it. If you're not convinced of that, just witness what's happened in the last few weeks. The Pope goes on tour, and a God-hating, secular society like America actually stops everything they're doing. They put down everything, and they wander after the beast. So we'll come to that in time. But what Revelation 10 and part of 11 are giving us are preparations that are necessary for both the revelation of the Western Antichrist and the survival of the church, if you will, in that time. What we're going to see is, in fact, part of it has reference to the Great Reformation from Popery. And there is there's something to be said for some of the imagery referring to the turning back of Popery. That there is the everlasting gospel being proclaimed in the midst of this apostasy in the West. In the East, Islam has its way. Christianity, in a certain respect, almost becomes a private affair and is driven underground. In the West, that's not really happening. And the West doesn't learn the lesson any more than the East did with regard to this image worship, the idolatry. The West never gives that up either. The Roman Church is full of statuary. And they bow down to this and they kiss the feet of stone saints and all of that. They're big into idolatry along with the East. So just as the end of Revelation 9 told us, they're not repenting. You know, even seeing what's happening to the East, it doesn't put the West in a state of mind to repent. They're not interested in that. So what we have is the same kind of pause here. If you remember a few chapters ago, when there's a transition from heathen Rome to imperial Rome, or Christian imperial Rome, there's a change, there's a lull, and there's a marking of the foreheads of those people, the people of God, who are not going to get caught up in that, the watering down of the faith as the world pours into the church. People of God are still marked out. They're being kept, even in the midst of this continual degradation of Christianity. In this chapter, and as I say in part of the next, which is joined to it, what we see is a similar preparation being made for what can only be described as the revelation of the Western Antichrist. So as the Western Antichrist is growing, the church does not just go away. And there are reasons for that. But it's going to take a particular form. And it's going to enter into a state that is not as institutionally stable as the Roman Church. Nonetheless, God will keep his people. He'll preserve his people. And so there's a preparation going on here. There's really a little bit of explanation, a backstory of the things that not only lead up to this woe that is going to be unleashed on the Western Church, but also it's more of it's more of an explanation as to, you know, what's going on and why. Because frankly, when the Western Antichrist begins its ascension and the Eastern Antichrist is chewing up the church in the Eastern Empire, Christianity looks like it's in pretty sad shape throughout the world. You know, in the East, so much of it was subjugated to Islam, and in the West, it's going to be subjugated to Romanism. So we want to look at this. The portion of Revelation chapter 10 through 11, 14, this whole section really represents in the prophetic scheme a parenthesis then to declare what precedes the seventh trumpet. That's the point of this. It's giving us that backstory. Right, we want to look first then at Revelation 10, verse 1.
Revelation 10, verse 1. And I saw another mighty angel come down from heaven, clothed with a cloud, and a rainbow was upon his head, and his face was as it were the sun, and his feet as pillars of fire.
Yeah, this is very much, if you remember, we've had this angel show up a couple of times already. In chapter 7, sealing in chapter 7, and also in chapter 8, with the altar of incense. Now, in chapter 10, the same angel, this mighty angel, is making a third appearance in the visions. And this mighty angel is Jesus again. This is who we're looking at, Jesus. He's the mighty angel here. He's the mighty messenger of God. We see several things described. We see a cloud, a rainbow, sun, and fire. So the fact that he's clothed in a cloud, that's telling us that in this aspect, he's obscured from our vision. We don't see through the cloud. We don't see in the cloud. We don't really perceive what's there. Cloud blocks us from seeing. It makes us unable to perceive the reality. And that's exactly it. And that's exactly why this chapter is telling us what it is and what's going on. Because we won't perceive the reality for what it really is. We only look on the outward appearance of things. We don't really look behind the scenes. So we need to understand that behind all of providence is Christ. He's at work. And he's the one who's carrying out all the things that we've seen and all the things that we will see happen in history. He's at the center of all history, and he is the one who is, in fact, unfolding. Remember, he's the Lamb who was slain and able to open that book with the seven seals. The rainbow upon his head points to that everlasting covenant. He's made a covenant with creation. If you remember, the rainbow was a covenant with creation, that he wouldn't destroy the world with a flood again. He's wearing that because that is, in fact, determinative of his actions. He's bound himself by this covenant. He wears it on his head. It's on his head. You can't forget it. His face is as the sun because his face is unlike the Old Testament, which is the light of the moon. His face, the revelation of the New Testament, the face of Christ, is like the light of the sun. There's a brightness to it. So it's referring to the revelation that we have in and through him. Finally, we have here, we're told that his feet were as pillars of fire. Pillars of fire are emblems of legs walking through the earth. If you remember him walking through the furnace of fire, and his feet, at the beginning of Revelation, we're told his feet were like brass that was burnished in the fire. This is the same person here. His feet are like pillars of fire. They're like the legs, the feet on legs that have walked through fire. And that fire is, in fact, the purity of his providence here. Fire is a purifying agent in the Bible. And so as he's going through history, he's purifying it. He is, in fact, turning it all the way he wants it to be. He's turning it all to glorify him. I want to look now at Revelation 10, verse 2.
Revelation 10, 2. And he had in his hand a little book open, and he set his right foot upon the sea, and his left foot on the earth.
So the angel has in his hand, we're told, a little book. And that's not, it shouldn't be confused with the sealed book at the beginning of Revelation. It's not the same. The sealed book is different in that it was closed. This little book is open. Remember, the seventh seal is not yet... the seventh trumpet hasn't sounded yet. The seventh seal, when he broke that, he opens up the whole scroll, the whole book. But this little book is not the same, because this book is open and it's being contrasted. Unlike that book, which is being unfolded as the providence of history is being unfolded, this book is already open. It's another one of these events where we're given sort of a backstage pass to history. From that providential point of view, we're being told something about why history is falling out the way it is. And we're being pointed to find the purpose of all history in Christ. That ultimately is what we should be looking at here. This book represents, in fact, an exposition of all the events that at least begin prior to the seventh trumpet. So there are things that have to prepare the way, if you will, before that seventh trumpet, before the third woe. And his action, the fact that he set his right foot upon the sea, his left foot on the earth, that represents Jesus, the mediator, claiming dominion over both empire and people. He's claiming to have a dominion over all of them. He's got them all under his feet. You know, what is the promise that was given to Christ, but that the seed of the serpent would be crushed under his foot, and that the church would be the instrument that he would use to crush the seed of the serpent, that he has to reign until every enemy is placed under his feet, because the earth is to be God's footstool. Right now his footstool is in rebellion, and so he's putting his feet down to demonstrate he has dominion. He has what we would call original jurisdiction. He has a right to rule. Revelation 10, verse 3, then.
Revelation 10, verse 3. And cried with a loud voice, as when a lion roareth. And when he had cried, seven thunders uttered their voices.
So the angel here cries with a loud voice as a lion. And that voice is described that way because he is the lion of the tribe of Judah. He may be the lamb slain from the foundation of the world, but he's also the lion of the tribe of Judah. He is the one who has the royal right of ruling. He is the king of the Jews, and he is, by reason of that office that he's occupied, reinvested in he's reinvested by his obedience that original jurisdiction and dominion. He's reclaimed what Adam lost, and so he has this dominion. And so he cries as a lion of the tribe of Judah. The result is that there are seven thunders that utter their voice. Now, thunders are judgments, but we will see in a moment that that really doesn't help our case. We know that there are judgments, but we're not going to see a whole lot of that because that gets sealed up. The seven thunders are seven judgments or seven really the number seven, if we think about it, it's a number of perfection. And so this seven is telling us that there's a perfection of judgment. There's some kind of event or events that will find completion or fulfillment before this woe and the seventh trump will sound. So just as the seventh trumpet is going to be the fullness of perfection for the trumpets, you know, we keep running into this number seven. That's what's going to happen here. Right now, the fact is that these thunders are, in fact, they're sealed up. We're going to look at verse 4.
Revelation 10, verse 4. And when the seven thunders had uttered their voices, I was about to write, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, seal up those things which the seven thunders uttered, and write them not.
So, the judgments are sealed up, and they're sealed until the seventh trumpet. John wants to write them, by the way, so he understands. But there's a mystery that must remain. And the mystery is revealed only gradually. That's what elsewhere in the Bible is called the mystery of iniquity. But there is a mystery. There's something obscure. There's something kept just out of his sight. He can't quite see it. What he does see, he can't write down. So it's just out of reach at several levels. He's not allowed to put it to paper because that's not the point. We're not being given this information in order to warn us about things that we could know as a result of other revelation. That's not the purpose of the book of Revelation. You have already been warned about the rise of Antichrist. You've been told about these things. Those who've been sealed in the forehead, they don't need to be told several times. They get it. And we will see in a moment that they get it. That there are people who still understand what's happening and why. That there is something going on that, in fact, is knowable, and that the people of God are prepared for it, and yet it doesn't need to be told at this point. It's not part of this parenthesis for this to be told. This, again, is behind the scenes. When we move out from behind this curtain, we will be given more information about the rise of the Western Antichrist, the woe, and all that will be that will transpire really before that seventh trumpet. It's telling us, in fact, that there's a lot leading up to that. So by the time we get to the seventh trumpet, which will consist in the destruction of Antichrist and the coming of the millennium. By the time we get to that, Antichrist will have already sped by in the course of the history of the Western Church. We're really going to be looking at Antichrist from a, sort of a rear-view mirror, prophetically, point of view. You know, it's already occurred. And it, from a prophetic point of view, it's already transpired. By the time we talk about this, we're being told about it sort of as an after story. You know, the whole history of Antichrist is held forth to us, but it's really going to be held forth to us right at that hinge of the seventh trump when the millennium begins. So the mystery of iniquity, you see, remember the apostle said it does already work. It's already work. It's hard to see where it rises up. And this is part of the problem when we get into looking too hard for the date where we're going to set the revelation of the Western Antichrist and all of that. And part of the reason it becomes problematic is because the origins, to some extent, are hidden. There are things that we can see, things that we know, and as we get closer to the end of that time, we should be able to see other things more clearly, at least hopefully we will. But the fact is that that stuff, for the most part, is hidden from view. When the Bible starts telling us, or John starts telling us about Antichrist, he's telling us about Antichrist as a complex that is being, that not only is, but has been defeated, if you will, on the eve of the millennium. All right, Revelation 10:5.
Revelation 10:5, and the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven.
And the angel which I saw stand upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his hand to heaven. That lifting up of the hand to heaven is, it's really the gesture of oath-taking. There's a covenant going on. And remember, now he already has on his forehead, or on his head, the rainbow, which is already one of the covenants that God has made with mankind. So there is here a remembrancing. There's an appeal to covenant. Christ is making an appeal. And the reason for this is, during this great apostasy that's going to befall in the West, you know, if you could imagine in the East, they've been overcome with Islam. That's an external force on the church. And it's driven it underground. It's caused all kinds of problems. But in the West, the force that is corrupting and destroying the church is not really from without, it's from within. The mystery of iniquity is from within. It's an internal corruption. Romanism brings with it an internal corruption. And so this covenant gesture that we have here is deeply tied to the preservation of a people even in the midst of this great apostasy. God's not going to wipe out all his people in this apostasy. He's not going to let the truth totally and finally fail in the midst of all of this apostasy. You know, there have been commentators who see all of this as leading up to and pointing to the reformation of the church. And I think there's some reason for seeing what we're talking about here, and we'll see, I think, a little bit more clearly in chapter 11, that there is reason to perceive at least part of what's going on in the Reformation of the Church. The Reformation is certainly a token, an acknowledgement, providentially, that this covenant is in effect, that there will always remain a church to worship God, to worship Christ according to his appointment. We're never going to lose the church altogether. Revelation 10, 6.
Revelation 10, verse 6. And swear by him that liveth forever and ever, who created heaven and the things that are there, that therein are, and the earth and the things that therein are, and the sea and the things which are therein, that there should be time no longer.
So what we see here is that oaths are only to be made with reference to and in the name of God. We shouldn't be swearing to all kinds of other things. We don't swear by heaven or earth, we swear by him who made the heaven and the earth. And that's what he's doing here. So this covenant, this oath-taking, this is going on with a clear view of establishing the connection for what follows, for this preparation for the seventh trump, which includes, among other things, the Reformation. All of that is rooted in this covenant. You know, and that may well be why Reformation theology has tended to be not just open to the idea of covenant, but Reformed theology is covenant theology, and so it may well, in some sense, be that this is referring to that idea in history, because there's an owning of the covenant here. That's really what's preserving the church, as you'll see in the West. There will be some that are left. Not all are going to get caught up in this apostasy. We're going to see in chapter 11 there are two witnesses, right? There's a competent number of witnesses that are going to be allowed to remain to bear testimony against this apostasy. Well, the basis for that, in terms of what we're watching in the book of Revelation, is the fact that there is this eternal covenant that God has made. We call it the covenant of redemption, whereby the Father gave to the Son a certain number of people. The Son agreed to die for that, for those people. That's his church, that's his body. And here, really, I think we have an appeal to that. There's an appeal going on to that. This is why people survive this apostasy. Not everyone's going to be carried away with it. Does it get bad? Yes, it gets bad. Does it get really bad? Oh, it gets really bad. You know, Romanism, as it progresses from generation to generation, is continually worse. It's a mystery of iniquity that's just gone haywire. We want to look now at the words at the end of that verse where he says that there should be time no longer. And I want to suggest here that we look at Daniel 12:9.
Daniel 12:9, and he said, "Go thy way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the end, till the time of the end."
Yeah, that actually seems to be more in line with what is meant here. Not that there should be time no longer, so much that he's saying the time is not yet. That is, the time of the end is not yet. That's the end of it all. It would be very, very possible. In fact, I think this is one of the great tragedies of premillennial and amillennial eschatology. It has this propensity to want to stop history at what could possibly be one of the worst times, worst points ever. They're always looking for history to end on the worst possible note with hardly any hint of redemption. The church just got beat up for decades, centuries, whatever. And at the end of it all, well, you know, the church really didn't make out very well in this world. It's over now. Good night. That's not... John is really giving us a different point of view here. You know, he's got this appeal to covenant. He's got this appeal to God as a covenant God. And this appeal ultimately has to do with the time of the end, which the time is not yet. That really could be, prophetically speaking, there are a couple of ways we can look at that. I mean, in an absolute way, we can say, well, the time of the end, he's talking about the end of time. In that sense, he's talking about Judgment Day. But I think it's more to the point here to say the time of the end, meaning the time of the overthrow of Antichrist, is not yet. And that's not going to happen until the seventh trump sound. So looking for it beforehand, the time is not yet. But on the other hand, the church is not going to perish. The gates of hell are not going to prevail against it. And I say that really based upon looking at verse 7, Revelation 10, 7.
Revelation 10, verse 7. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he shall begin to sound, the mystery of God should be finished as he hath declared it to his servants, the prophets.
So the time, that time of the end is really, I think we're told here, when the seventh trumpet sounds. It's not, and that indicates that we're looking for the overthrow. We're really looking for that final casting down. Remember, there's always this backward glance from John's apocalypse to Daniel, to Ezekiel, to a number of the prophets on a number of points, but he's looking here for the end, ultimately the end of the Roman Empire. And by the Roman Empire, he understands, or he should understand, not only that fourth kingdom, although that's true, right? He's going to be looking at the division of that fourth kingdom into ten toes, the removal of three, the setting up of one, you know, the little horn. That's the Western Antichrist. That's that that mystery of iniquity, and that's not going to be that's not going to come to an end. Even though it looks like it's wiping out the church, it's not going to come to an end until the seventh trumpet sounds. Right. This will precipitate. In fact, we're told here the finishing of the mystery of God, the seven thunders. So, the seventh trumpet, seven thunders are going to be finishing up about the time that the seventh trumpet sounds. And we really should probably take a look at Daniel 12:7 here.
Daniel 12, verse 7. And I heard the man clothed in linen which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swear by him that liveth for ever, that it shall be for a time, times, and an half. And when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all these things shall be finished.
So now we're given some interesting information here in Daniel. That really we're going to see come up again in chapter 11, this idea of time, times, and a half. 3.5 years, 42 months, 1260 days. This image comes up a lot in Daniel. It comes up again in Revelation. What is happening here in verse 7? Is we have the same solemn oath-taking used here as was in Daniel 12. It was used to give Daniel assurance. And I think that's what it's doing here with John. It's giving him assurance. You know, he's just been given this vision about the decimation of the Eastern Roman Empire. And the church in that place probably is not looking like it's in too good condition at the end of that. But in the West, it's going to look worse when we begin to examine it in many, many respects. And so he's given an assurance that this is not a forever prospect, and it's not going to wipe out everyone. It's limited, time, times, and a half a time. Not going to go on forever. There's a very clear time constraint. Again, I say that time constraint of 1260 days or a day for a year, the time of apostasy that is in view, it's notoriously tricky trying to figure out exactly when that began. In fact, there are and have been several points at which you can start and then count 1260 years, and there's an event, a significant event, that looks like a reversal to the papacy in some respect. And so it may well be that these seven mystery thunders, these seven judgments, there may be different points at which this 1260 years is sort of cycling through. There may be overlapping aspects. The reason why I think it's not quite as clear as we would like it to be is because the closer you can get to pinning that down, the closer you get to discovering exactly when the millennium begins, and then you have more chronology, more of a timetable than God has actually seen fit to give us. So I think there are things which are deliberately opaque, and as with so many other things, when that seventh trump sounds, when the mystery of iniquity is overturned, what we're going to find is you're going to be able to look back 1260 years and see it pretty clearly, what the date, you know, the final date would have been. But I won't be surprised to find that there were several other cycles of this. For example, you know, if we take the date when Phocas in 606 declares himself a universal bishop, and we add 1260 years to that, we come to the time of Vatican I, 1866, and At that time, the Roman pontiff was driven out of Rome by King Victor Emmanuel. The Roman church was reduced to poverty. You would have thought it was going to be the end of the Roman church. And the problem with the date, the 606 date, I think, is that you begin with a date that only has reference to the ecclesiastical aspect of Antichrist. But there's clearly a civil aspect as well. You know, Romanism is a quasi-political church. And the Reformation fought against it first as a church, but in Scotland they saw it as more than that. They saw it as a corrupted political system. So ultimately, I think what we have to understand is there is this aspect of Romanism that must answer, you know, in its downfall, it must answer to the civil aspect as well. Now, it was divested of civil power, you may say, but not ecclesiastical power at that time. And again, you may be inclined to think that, but in some respects, I actually think the Roman Church, the case could be made the Roman Church has more political power now, even if it has less ecclesiastical power. It doesn't have the vast control of people as a church. You know, not everybody in Europe, especially today, would consider themselves a Roman Catholic. They wouldn't be under the papacy. And yet, politically, Rome continues to exert an almost bizarre amount of influence in the world. So I throw that out just to say I think that there are potentially several different starting points depending on how we look at the question, how we approach the question. And I don't think that is actually unusual in the Bible to have different horizons of fulfillment. The point of this is that there is, on the one hand, there's a covenant God's made with his church. A covenant that's going to keep his church, keep his people. They're going to be preserved through this apostasy. That's being held forth here in chapter 10. In addition, as we compare the imagery to Daniel and we prepare to look forward to chapter 11 where we'll see the same times and half a time, we're reminded that this period is actually going to be a period that is limited in duration. It's not going to go on forever, and it's not going to encompass everyone. That's what the covenant means. It would deceive the very elect if it could, but it can't. Revelation 10:8.
And the voice which I heard from heaven spake unto me again, and said, Go and take the little book which is open in the hand of the angel that standeth upon the sea and upon the earth.
So, John's told at that point to take the little book, and the reason is that it's a book that has a message which is opened only by command. Here again is why ultimately I think we do have to consider that the Reformation and what we're going to call the Witnessing Church is always going to be in view here. because the message of the gospel, the message of this little book has to do with really maintaining an evangelical message, but a message that is keeping this truth alive, this covenant truth alive, in and through a time of apostasy. And that's a matter of command. The truth of God, revelation of God, is not something with respect to the gospel. The gospel is not a matter of natural revelation. It's a matter of special revelation, so it's open by command. Revelation 10:9.
And I went unto the angel and said unto him, give me the little book. And he said unto me, take it and eat it up, and it shall make thy belly bitter, and it shall be in thy mouth sweet as honey.
So what John did, we're told here, what he did was he took the book. He was told to take it. He took it. And then, contrary to probably to anything we might expect, John is told to eat the book. Now, we're told that the result is it was sweet in his mouth, but it was bitter in his belly. And here's where I think we begin to get into this idea of the witnessing church. John takes upon himself this open book. This is a book that, in essence, is the book of witness. It's the book of testimony, because by this book, those who are, in fact, commanded to take up this book, they're going to be in the position to recognize Antichrist, or who and what he is. And the idea of it being sweet in his mouth and bitter in his belly is telling us that that there's something about this message that literally is not going to sit well. The Protestants from the beginning were killed for their testimony against Romanism. You know, the message may have been sweet, but there was bitterness in the belly. They were forced out of themselves by this testimony. They were very often executed. Not just one or two, but thousands and even tens of thousands of people were executed. So this behind-the-scenes preparation that we're getting here in chapter 10 is, I think, very much like that preparation we saw, for example, chapter 7, when the angel's flying and sealing the heads of the people of God. Here, the people of God aren't being sealed in their heads so much, but they're being given this little... John's being given this book to eat, to ingest, and it's sweet in his mouth because the gospel is sweet. It's bitter in his belly because the implications, the ramifications for the church are really going to be quite staggering. We'll see some of this again later on in later chapters when he begins to consider the identity of Antichrist. When it's revealed to him who exactly has become Antichrist in the West. It's not going to strike him as something obvious. When he sees it, when he perceives it for what it is, it's going to shock him. And frankly, it should. It should be very shocking. Because it's contrary to the very nature of the gospel. Again, there's a sweetness in his mouth, but a bitterness in the belly. Revelation 10:10.
Revelation 10:10. I took the little book out of the angel's hand and ate it up, and it was in my mouth sweet as honey, and as soon as I had eaten it, my belly was bitter.
So he does what he's told. He eats it. He's obedient. He's a disciple. But in order to understand what it signifies, we'll look at Ezekiel 3:1-3.
Ezekiel 3:1-3. Moreover, he said unto me, Son of man, eat that thou findest. Eat this roll, and go speak unto the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said unto me, Son of man, cause thy belly to eat, and fill thy bowels with this roll that I give thee. Then did I eat it, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness.
So there's a certain amount of pleasure that can be taken in the words, but there's bitterness for those people who actually ingest them, for those who move beyond what we might call speculative knowledge, for those who truly believe. It's going to go beyond being just a lot of pleasantries. Religion is nice, it's pleasant, as long as you don't take it too seriously. But once you begin to take it seriously, you come into conflict with this world. You know, they don't have a problem with you as long as you're not really going to believe and act upon what you profess to believe and act upon. They don't have a problem with a verbal profession. But once it becomes part of you, you're going to enter into that conflict. And that's where John finds himself, because John is part of the church. He's in a position to see himself and see, on behalf of the church, all of that. So again, we have here this parenthesis that's giving us some kind of an insight as to what's coming and why. There is an apostasy coming, but it's not the end of the world. There is a very broad falling away, but it won't be everyone. There is a very, very cast down condition for the church to occupy, but there'll still be a church. You know, all of the things that arise in the West, all of the problems that accrue because of the revelation of the Antichrist, all of these things are just temporary setbacks for the church. It may look bad, it may look terrible, it may be terrible going through it. In verse 11.
Revelation 10:11. And he said unto me, Thou must prophesy again before many peoples and nations and tongues and kings.
Yeah, so what we're told here is this is a matter of prophecy. And this is important because what he has just received in ingesting this book, what he's received is the substance of the prophecy, the message that will be the message of the two witnesses in chapter 11. In other words, John is now, he's come upon and he's put himself in a position of being in agreement with and communion with what is or will be during the time of the apostasy, the witnessing church. And not all of the church will apostatize. There will be two witnesses. That is, there will be a competent number of witnesses, as we'll see, who don't go into this corruption. There are always going to be a church left to worship God according to His appointment. It may not be big. I think right now it's not very big. There aren't a lot of people who aren't corrupted by this and by the influences of this. But despite all of that, truth is not going to fail. There's a covenant. The apostasy is not going to go on forever. It's time sensitive. There's a limitation. Wherever we're going to set that date, and we will discuss some possibilities. We'll talk about the whys. We're getting close to the end of certain potential dates. Next year marks a potential end date for one way of dating the apostasy. Is that significant? I don't know. And we won't know until the time is come and gone. We'll see. And that really should be our attitude with a lot of these prophetical things where we move from what is knowable to what is speculation. Again, history interprets prophecy. So after we've moved beyond a period of time, it's much easier to see. This chapter is not making any predictions. It's just simply telling us that behind the scenes of not just the apostasy, but more importantly, behind the scenes of what we now see from this last verse will be the witnessing church, is this claim of dominion that Christ is making over the entire earth. Now that should tell us something about the nature of the witnessing church. The witnessing church ought to be witnessing on behalf of Christ the mediator. You know, it should be concerned about the mediatorial reign of Christ, the witnessing church. There's a reason why I think being Reformed Presbyterian is, in fact, the proper stance to take during this time. And that's part of it right there. Now we see that Christ is asserting mediatorial dominion. And as part of that, he gives John a book to eat, this little book. This book is clearly a book that is meant to instruct and shape the prophecy, the message of the witnesses that we're going to read about in chapter 11. I don't think you can get around that. And once you begin to consider that, then you have to consider this whole concept of Christ's mediatorial reign, what it entails, and why. And that's where the Church of Scotland, beyond any of the other Reformed churches, they begin to push there harder and farther than anyone before them. Think of it in this sense, with respect to the early church struggle. The early church, the martyrs of the early church, were testifying on behalf of Christ, the great prophet of his church. They were sealing with their blood the testimony that he is the prophet. The Reformation was about sealing with the blood of the martyrs testimony that Christ is the great priest over his church. The Covenanters alone are the ones who began to lay down their lives for the proposition Christ is the king of his church. And we know that Christ is a prophet, priest, and king. The little book that John takes, sweet to the taste, but it's when he ingests it, when he swallows it, it's bitter in his stomach. Why? Because it always ends in martyrdom. And in chapter 11, we'll see that the witness, the prophecy, the witness of the witnessing church ends in martyrdom. That's the end of it in the face of an unbelieving world. They don't want to hear this. And so while I'm less concerned about nailing down every exacting date, I will say again that there are a lot of candidates for dates. There are a couple of good ones, one of which, as I said, ends next year. But they're not sure things, although I think if the start date is significant enough, we will see some kind of answerability. Even if it's not the full end, we will see some shadow of fulfillment at the end of that period, if it really represents one of these 1,260-year cycles, if you will. So next time, we'll look at Chapter 11. I want to talk about the Witnessing Church. I want to talk about what they're doing, the prophecy, the prophesying, and the end of it all. We'll finish up this parenthesis that we found begun here. And we'll move on to talk about the seventh trumpet. And then we're going to see, having hit that the book of Revelation does something very interesting that makes us examine a lot of these things over again.
Stillwater's Revival Books is now located at puritandownloads.com. It's your worldwide online Reformation home for the very best in free and discounted classic and contemporary Puritan and Reformed books, MP3s, and videos. For much more information on the Puritans and Reformers, including the best free and discounted classic and contemporary books, MP3s, digital downloads, and videos, please visit Stillwater's Revival Books at puritandownloads.com. Stillwater's Revival Books also publishes the Puritan Hard Drive, the most powerful and practical Christian study tool ever produced. All thanks and glory be to the mercy, grace, and love of the Lord Jesus Christ for this remarkable and wonderful new Christian study tool. The Puritan Hard Drive contains over 12,500 of the best Reformation books, MP3s, and videos ever gathered onto one portable Christian study tool. An extraordinary collection of Puritan, Protestant, Calvinistic, Presbyterian, Covenanter, and Reformed Baptist resources. It's fully upgradable and it's small enough to fit in your pocket. The Puritan Hard Drive combines an embedded database containing many millions of records with the most amazing and extraordinary custom Christian search and research software ever created. The Puritan Hard Drive has been produced to assist you in the fascinating and exhilarating spiritual, intellectual, familial, ecclesiastical, and societal adventure that is living the Christian life. It has been specifically designed so that you might more faithfully know, serve, and love the Lord Jesus Christ, as well as to help you to do all you can to bring glory to His great name. If you want to love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, then the Puritan Hard Drive is for you. Visit PuritanDownloads.com today for much more information on the Puritan Hard Drive and to take advantage of all the free and discounted Reformation and Puritan books, MP3s, and videos that we offer at Stillwater's Revival Books.